Go.
Right now? Are we on the air, lady skill,
yes,
now?
Yes, we
are. Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, yo, bust a move.
This is Dennis Tech of Radio Birdman, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
The Catskill High School Interact Club has scheduled its Martin Luther King March for Peace and Justice for February 17th. The event meets at the Second Baptist Church in Catskill at 5 p.m. Then a candlelight march starts at 5:15 p.m. The group will march from the Second Baptist Church, that's at Upper Main Street on Catskill, to the Greene County Courthouse, to the Catskill Middle School lawn. That is, again, the Martin Luther King March for Peace and Justice, February 17th, organized by the Catskill High School Interact Club. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org for more information about this event and many other community events in your area.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Bindlestiff Family Circus of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Good evening. Thank you for joining. I am Kimberly Y. Irwin, your host of Race Talks tonight on WGXC 90.7 FM. Here, every third Tuesday of the month from about 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. is where we have the very necessary conversation on race and ethnicity. Why talk about race? To combat racism. Education is key and discussion a must. There's one race, the human one, and many ethnicities. The bottom line is you'll find us keeping it real on Race Talks, where
no topic is
no topic.
Okay, great. That's the first thing my guests do. They let you know that no topic is taboo on Race Talks. So let's get started immediately because we have two guest talkers who, like me, can talk. And they are also childhood friends and members of the Greene and Columbia counties that when I give their introductions, their bios, you will know for sure why I've chosen them on today's topic, race and wealth. And I just want to also mention, because I have gotten some feedback on my LinkedIn page and my Facebook Messenger and other social media outlets to make people think that this is a Black conversation, and it really isn't. This is about the human race, and we are just one members of it. So this is a segment that everyone should get something out of. Hopefully, maybe even a giggle or two, because we are keeping it real. We're all looking like we're in our living room, so I'm going to get started with introducing my first guest. His name is William Bill Hughes Jr. I like to call him Junior, and so many of us do that grew up with him. But before he served for 4 years on the City of Hudson Council and 10 years on the Columbia County Board of Supervisors with 8 of those years as minority leader, he was just Junior to us, growing up in Hudson High School. Currently though, Mr. Hughes, as some people who haven't been able to say they've known him since when he was in school, serves on the New York State Democratic Committee, and he's also an executive board member of the Democratic Rural Conference. Bill, or Junior, as I like to call him, is also a businessman. He is the co-founder and chief community officer of, and I think I'm going to say this right, TIVA, T-I-V-A, LLC, an adult use cannabis startup, which is designed to create opportunities for individuals and communities that were put at risk by the war on drugs in America. His personal interests is one of the things, reasons that I wanted him particularly on the show, because I'm getting into crypto. And this led him to establish an invitation-only social media group primarily to serve the Black community by providing for potential investment opportunities in cryptocurrency and sharing breaking news on technology that serves it. Tonight, you will get some of that breaking news that only specific members of his social media page can get. So stay tuned. Already, he has a growing following and has benefited a number of his site's exclusive membership of family, close friends, and business associates. Bill maintains his home in Columbia County in Hudson, where he grew up. Bill, or Junior, or Will, can you please share some insights on why you feel it's great to be here tonight on race while we're discussing race and wealth?
Sure. First, I'd like to thank you for inviting me to be a part of this discussion. You have my brother, Jake Walthour, here, who really would have a lot to offer, I'm sure, when it's talking finances. As you said, with my background, I spent a lot of years in government. And while I was there, I saw the glaring disparities amongst our youth, how programs were being doled out in government. And sometimes it was intentional, but a lot of times it wasn't intentional. It was just the fact of not having the proper knowledge. And so after I got out of government, I decided to, pursue the business avenue myself. And I'm still doing that as far as cannabis goes. But with crypto, I realized that it was going to offer a real opportunity for the Black community and really the underserved community that we haven't had offered in the history of this country, in my opinion. It just hadn't been offered at that level. And I think once we get into it, I could explain some of the ideas and some of the things that I see that are coming down the pike that would back up what I'm saying.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And of course, you're always welcome on the show. This is actually our second time being on air together. We were also on like the afternoon show, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So you are always welcome. And of course, Mr. Walthour would probably think that I've saved the best for last. So let me get into describing our good friend, Jacob Walthour Jr., who is Chief Executive Officer and Managing Partner of Blueprint Capital Advisors. With over 30 years of experience in capital markets, investment banking, traditional and alternative asset management, Mr. Walthour manages all aspects of the firm's business and investment activities and chairs the investment committee. And prior to founding this company, he served as head of various investment management and consulting firms. His first career move was at Lehman Brothers, the once fourth largest banking institution in the United States. And if memory is serving me correctly, when I used to work at the World Trade Center, that's one time I ran into you, Jacob, I believe. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the past too and how we went from being low people on the totem poles to where we are now. So that's great. But before I let you even speak, let me finish up here. Among the various roles, Jacob gives his time serving as chairman of Ebony Media Holdings, the iconic Black multimedia company chronicling the lives of African Americans for 75 years. Black Enterprise magazine recognized him as one of the most influential Black people on Wall Street. He gives us his time and knowledge of the financial industry with vigor as a featured guest on CNBC and contributor of a variety of articles published in Vanity Fair, The Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Forbes, and Bloomberg. Jacob, who resides part-time in Columbia County, graduated as a BA cum laude from the Nelson Rockefeller School at the State University of New York at Albany. I remember some parties I was up there and saw you hanging out there. Anyway, you remain connected to your roots in Hudson. For Hudson High School in 2021, you, Jacob, provided the graduation address to much applause. So welcome. And you please also do share some info with our guests, our audience tonight about why you feel the topic of race and wealth is important and dear to your heart at this time.
Thanks, Kim, Kimberly, Kessa, given that we all have known each other for so long.
Yes, you can call me all three. We're in our living rooms.
We've seen each other's lives sort of transform from being, you know, ashy-kneed little kids to, you know, to serious adults trying to make a difference in the world. And so let me say to both of you, I'm honored to be here to share this platform with the two of you. I've done a lot of panels in my day, and I've never had an opportunity to really be on a panel with people who I've known for so long. I mean, people who not only I have been friends with my entire life, but my parents were friends with almost their entire life. And so I got to tell you, it's sort of an emotional experience for me, not just to be with the two of you who I'm so connected with, but also to be in front of people who know me so well back in Columbia County and back in the great city of Hudson, where, you know, I grew up. And, you know, when you talk about my bio, you know, the one thing that you fail to mention is, as I like to put it, you know, I'm just a kid from Hudson who left to do some things that, you know, he'd always wanted to do when he grew up there, and who's now back because I love the place and I want to have a positive difference or make a positive difference in the lives of people who are still there. As we all know, Hudson's gone through a major transformation over the course of the last 20 years. And I remember a time when I used to walk up and down the streets of Hudson and I didn't even have to know a kid's name. All I had to do was look at that kid's face. And I could tell you whether that kid was a Mackey or a Clanton or a Sheldon or a Hughes or a Freeman or an Irwin, just by their facial structure. Now when I go home, you know, I rarely even see people who I know. And so the city's gone through a major transformation. And I'm hoping that, you know, we can use a piece of this show to talk about what has happened there. Because at the end of the day, when I look at what's going on in Hudson, I do see it being about race and I do see it being about wealth. And so I think it'd be interesting for us to touch on kind of what's going on there now and how we might all be able to shine a spotlight on the things that are good and the things that need improving.
That's so wonderful that you mentioned, you know, the families in Hudson. I always used to share with people that because my grandmother, she was very enterprising. She had a chicken shack on Columbia Street, and that shack is still there. It's more of a shack than it ever was. But when I first came back to Hudson, because we were all kind of like, you know, supplanted ourselves other places and returned to some extent. And that's good because I think to know more of ourselves, we have to go away from what we know and to come back and to see and to feel the differences. But I think it's important to shout out to not just people who are members of today's lifestyle and breathing, but from those who have gone on and that we in social media and in person, we look at resting in peace because it's their shoulders that we are on. And I know that my mom and my grandmother, their strength, their advocacy for me in the school system is really what helped me get an education, which allowed me to travel the world and work in the world and allows me to make income wherever I'd like to make an income because I have the basic education that's that I can stand on. So I want to thank my mother and my grandmother, Patricia Ann Irwin and Helen Irwin. And I'd like for you all to, from you both, to also acknowledge maybe those members of your family that are no longer with us, but you can give a shout out to. I think that's really relevant that we talk first about our families.
Yeah, well, you know, as people who know me know, my mom passed in September, who was really a supporting cast for me. You know, she was a rock for me, and she did a lot of things for me and my family. My role model was my father. And a lot of people in the community, who was William Hughes Sr., and Jake would know this as well, a lot of people in the community would know my father for his kindness, but really his hard work. You know, he worked around the clock, 24 hours, but there wasn't anything that he wouldn't do for our family and friends. You know, he raised us with tough love. He was very disciplined, and he made sure that we were very disciplined. And a lot of that rubbed off on me. And so my work ethic is not like, it's close, not like my father's though, it's close. You know, my characters and mannerisms are a lot like his as well. And I didn't realize it until I got older, but now I see that a lot of him has rubbed off on me.
Awesome. And Jake, of course, you recently had.
Sure. You know, it's really hard when I think about Hudson to separate, you know, friends from family. You know, it was always a really small town and everyone felt like they were family. But, you know, I first have to honor my father. We just kind of celebrated the anniversary of his passing on the 14th of December. And, you know, my dad worked alongside Will's dad for so long. I think they spent their whole entire working lives together until Will's dad passed. And Will's dad was like a dad to me too. And when he wasn't working, he was taking us fishing or taking us hunting. And when he was doing that, my dad just continued to work because they had the same work ethic. Many people don't know this, but up until his mom passed, my mom and his mom, Barbara and Frances, spoke every single day, every single day. My mother's an incredibly strong woman, has obviously been the air underneath my wings. Strong and having buried both of her parents and 9 siblings, you know, Miss Frances became, you know, her sister. And she was always, you know, a sister to my father because she was one of the first people to look after him when he migrated here from Georgia. And I don't think for a second it was a coincidence that, you know, Mrs. Frances passed on my father's birthday and they were reunited.
I didn't know that. And you know, look down
on us and support us and smile upon us. But the families, the friendships in the city of Hudson are really what propelled me to where I am today. Yes, I've met a lot of people along the way as I went on to college and I moved to New York City. But it was all those people in Hudson who said to me, look, you're going to do something special. Who said, don't take the left turn, take the right turn. Who said, no, you don't want to get involved in this, you know, go somewhere else and spend your time. Who made sure that, you know, I had the foundation to make the right decisions in life to lead to where I got today. And I'm forever in debt to all the people in the city of Hudson. And it's not just, you know, people who were in, you know, the African-American communities, people in the other communities as well, who, you know, made me realize that, you know, from a race perspective, people could get along, people could support one another. And it was one of the things I really valued about Hudson is that I had this experience where I think I got through high school and never once in my life had a racial incident. And it wasn't until I got to college that I realized, you know, how important race was and where people sat from a political, social, and economic perspective.
Yeah, let's get into that. I want to insert my first segment, which is called DYK, Did You Know? So this is information coming from the Survey of Consumer Finances, which was done in 2019. This is the newest data that they have, and I'm just going to read a few segments here that I feel that we can use for a base of our discussion when it comes to what we are what we've learned and what we see in our own selves, in our own family, in our own lives to make a change for our situation when it comes to finances. Going forward. So the new data from the 2019 Survey of Consumer Finances show that longstanding and substantial wealth disparities between families in different racial and ethnic groups were little changed since the last survey in 2016. And I will say, many people say little changed from when the country was built in the 1600s. Well, actually it was probably the late 16th century, but definitely in the 1600s, right around the time when slavery was instituted, nothing really has changed much. So when I'm reading this data, I'm really talking about the life of the country. So they mention the fact that the typical white family has 8 times the wealth of the typical Black family and 5 times the wealth of the typical Hispanic family. It also mentions that as white, non-Hispanic, Black or African American, non-Hispanic, Hispanic or Latino, and other or multiple race, which they use the term race and I use the term ethnicities, they define wealth as the difference between families' gross assets and their liabilities. So I like the term wealth because it doesn't mean how much money you actually are earning. It's really how much you have at your disposal at any given time. And I wanted to start with our families because people get wealth through family, through small family, when we talk about mothers, fathers, sisters, and brothers, to extended families that can include aunts and uncles, because a lot of people give wealth away as they pass on. And that's one of the things that I also want to talk about is how does wealth pass through? And the term using one agency, which is insurance. But because again, if families don't earn during their life, they have nothing to accumulate. Then when they die, there's nothing to pass on. And we learn from slavery that many slaves, African-Americans that came, well, Black people that came from Africa, didn't have any ownership. And over time, with many different ways that were established for general Americans to prosper, especially after wars where people were given the ability to borrow money to then finance an education or a home. And we also know that home ownership is something that can be transferred into wealth, a lot of which the whole family of African-American and other people who didn't have this ability because of racial discrimination cannot forward the wealth to the next generation or any wealth to the next generation. So I'm going to end with, did you know? With this information, white families have the highest level of both median and mean family wealth between $188,000 to $983,000. Black and Hispanic families have considerably less wealth than white families. Black families' median and mean wealth is less than 15% of that of wealth of white families. It comes in at $24,000 to $142,000. So the highest number, $142,000, doesn't reach the lowest number for white families, $188,000. And then we have Hispanic families' median and mean wealth coming in even higher than African-American families, $36,000 to $165,000. So that range is so large, but it starts very low, under $50,000 in both the African-American and Latino homes. So it also talks about Asian, American, Indian, Alaskan Native, Native Hawaiian, Pacific and Islanders, and other race respondents showing lower wealth than white families, but higher wealth than Black and Hispanic families. And that is a conversation I would imagine for the next time, next day. But I did want to bring that information up. So my question is, did you know this information and how does it pertain to what you do know with your financial background and your cryptocurrency new ideas and the going forward?
So was it Jake or me first?
Hey, we don't have to. Yeah, you go, Bill.
Okay. So I actually do know that study. It was a 2019 study. And I usually follow it every year. But it usually comes out every 2 to 3 years when they do the median income and median family wage in the country based on the census and whatever they're taking. But when you look at all those things, Kim, some of the points you touched on, and Jake, well, I'm sure as a finance person, will be able to touch on this too. A big part of being able to transfer wealth or to generate wealth in a family, our families, and not us, our parents figured it out early because they owned assets. You know, they both owned homes. And you know, say what you want. Had you bought a home back when our parents bought it and then sold it today, I mean, you're transferring, just that is transferring a great deal of wealth. Now, if you have a job that has a pension that comes with a retirement fund, it's additional wealth that you're transferring. You know, so there are mechanisms that can be in place that would allow you to transfer wealth to the next generation. You have to be cognizant of that and pursue that. And two, you know, and one of the things that I do constantly, I'm constantly trying to figure out, how do I save? How do I invest? Not for myself, but for my daughter. And my father used to always say this, and I'm sure Jake's did as well, is they want us to be better off than they were. And so I want my daughter to be better off than we are. And I'm going to make sure that that is indeed the case.
So what you're saying is home ownership is essential. And see that too, because
when you look at that $188,000, I bet a big part of that is not what people earn. It's what people were able to build through home ownership.
I totally agree with that. Jake, would you agree with that information or?
Let me start with, I did know about the study and I'm pretty well versed in those statistics. And, you know, here in New Jersey where I'm sitting right now, I was asked to testify before a joint committee of both houses of the legislature on the economic disparities that exist between white households and Black and Hispanic households. And one of the things that I found most disturbing about the statistics here in New Jersey is that the statistics really don't differ from the statistics that you would see in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Kentucky, where, you know, one views racist activity, one views equal opportunity as being a real challenge versus a blue state in the kind of more liberal Northeast corridor of the United States. And so while, you know, we go back a really long way to the Great Migration from the South to the North to find freedom, we truly have not really found kind of the economic promised land here in the Northeast. And our situation rivals that of our relatives who decided to stay in the South. And so it's disappointing to me that in places like New York, New Jersey, you have these wide economic disparities. And I think that, just to be direct, there's really only one way to explain them. It has a lot to do with the legacy of that awful institution that we call slavery, that then migrated into Jim Crow, that then migrated into segregation, that has now become kind of more invisible systemic racism that still impacts African-American and Latino households. And having said that, and on record as saying that that is one of the biggest drivers of those disparities, I do have to acknowledge one thing you said, Kim, at the beginning, which is that things haven't changed, but I do think they have. And we are all shining examples of how things have changed. I think if we were to, you know, rewind the clock, you know, 150 years, rewind the clock 100 years, rewind the clock 50 years, but chances are the three of us, you know, would not be doing what we're doing today. Our ancestors were able to make progress. Our parents were able to make progress. And as Will put it, that one goal that they always had was that our lives would be easier than their lives. And I think, you know, from that perspective, all of our families were successful. And in some ways, you know, that kind of leads me to conclude and to believe that what we call the American dream is still achievable. It may not be achievable for everybody, but I do still think that it is achievable if you make the right decisions. It's achievable if You believe in yourself. It's achievable if you're willing to overcome obstacles. It's achievable if you're not willing to look at our history and say something is not possible.
I want to jump in right now, Jake, because I think I want to make sure everyone understands that I'm saying that the change, what is not change, is the disparity. There's right. still the large disparity, and it's very similar. That's the difference. Right. And I mean, I guess that's where I'm saying it's not changed. Even during slavery, there were free Black people and there were wealthy Black people, mm-hmm. right? And there was even a handful of people who actually owned slaves. So there was always a group of people who were able to, let me just finish. There was a group of people who were always able to ascend, but just that same amount of people. I'm looking at, when you were talking about home ownership, I'm thinking that was key. And you talked about Jim Crow and segregation. My aunt, I remember trying to, Miss Mary Robinson, she was a housekeeper. And it wasn't until a Jewish woman helped her get her home because they didn't want to sell the home to a Black person. So even when you had money, when you had everything that you talked about, there was still something blocking your path to success. And you needed the help. And you needed the help of some other. And I mean, there's another story. I know another friend of ours, a Carr family member, who in Brooklyn, she wanted to buy a home, but she only could buy that home because she was so light-skinned, they thought she was passing for being white. So that color difference continues to affect us in some ways. So maybe not so much now, but it has changed to a point where it doesn't make a difference now to certain people that you said can ascend in ways with education and grit. Let's discuss how that happens.
Let me say this, because I do think that's important. We have a choice. We can look at the glass as being half empty, or we can look at the glass as being half full. And in my world, and I try and teach my kids this, look at the glass as half full. So when we talk about these disparities and where they are today, let's rewind to the beginning of time when they started actually tracking these kinds of statistics. At one point in this country, we were property. We were not allowed to own property. At one point in this country, we were forced to be part of a system that gave us land, and we could never work our way out of, you know, sort of paying off that land. It was basically indentured servitude. We could not attend educational institutions at all. We were not allowed to eat in certain places. We were not allowed to drink from certain water fountains.
I'm going to say I get it, because I want you to talk about, and I know that's why you're here, to share what we can be doing now as a group mm-hmm. of people to go forward, because that's your knowledge base. So we know the history, right? And I think we're gonna all agree with the history. And yes, we need to now go forward. So let's talk about some suggestions that you have from how, like you said, you mentioned you talk to your children. What are you sharing with them? What are they getting from you being a financial whiz?
I wouldn't consider myself to be a financial whiz.
I know, but you wouldn't, but I can say that. I don't have that kind of knowledge.
Look, lesson number one is, if you don't know your history, you're condemned to repeat it. And so knowing your history is absolutely a critical component to navigating, life here in America. And so it's really important that they do that. So if you want to sort of skip.
I'm just going to say the critical race theory is a good idea in school.
Look, I don't think that there's any topic that schools should be intentionally avoiding. If they're of interest to students who have curious minds, by all means, we should open up institutions to talking about them. And politics out of school is an absolute good thing. But trying to get to where you want to go with the conversation, I'm going to go back to what Will said earlier. That there are mechanisms for transferring wealth. home ownership. I think you mentioned, Kim, insurance policies. In order for you to get to that point where you understand how to transfer wealth from one generation to another, I think it first requires an education. An education, or what we'll just call financial literacy. And what I find is that our public schools, no matter where they are, whether they be in the inner cities of Detroit or they be in, you know, Manhattan, Kansas, the bottom line is that our school systems don't teach financial literacy. They don't teach about saving. Our culture encourages spending. They think that, you know, insurance policies are in place to pay for funerals. They don't know that insurance policies are a way of transferring wealth. They think they're supposed to own a house in their name. They don't understand that it may be best from a tax perspective for a trust to actually own the house. And so I think the critical component to wealth creation is understanding from an educational perspective, not just how to accumulate wealth, but how to actually transfer the wealth and what all these mechanisms mean. When I grew up in Hudson, I was fortunate in that my parents owned a business, right? And so one would think that in the mornings when I sat down at the table and they were counting money and trying to figure out, you know, what the next decision was going to be that was going to impact their business, that I would have come away from the table being extremely financially literate. While I understood how their business worked and I understand the basics of business, what I didn't understand was this whole concept of, you know, retirement planning and, you know, how wealth was transferred. It wasn't until I graduated from college and I went to work at Morgan Stanley and someone came in my office one day. And he said, I'm sending someone in to see you. And that person who came in was his insurance agent. And that person sat down with me and did calculations, which said, in order for me to retire, and he asked me what age I wanted to retire at, and I said 55. He said, well, this is how much money you need in the bank. And he said, you can go get a tattoo and put that on your hand, because that's how much money you're going to
What was it?
At 55. I'm sorry?
Can you share the amount it was?
At that point, it was like $6,543,000.
Oh, you wanted to live well then.
Right? So, no, that's what I was going to have to, that's what I was going to have to save to retire at 55, continue my lifestyle the way it existed, and not have to compromise, keeping in mind that I had four children who were destined to go to college and then probably do some graduate school. I had a home. I had parents who may need some level of financial support. And so it wasn't just about like what I was going to do going forward. It was all of these things all of a sudden started going into the calculation. And it made me realize just how broke I was. And that if I didn't stop spending and start saving, I probably was never going to retire at 55 as I wished. And then he did other calculations, which said, you know, hey, maybe you ought to retire at 65, right? And if you retire at 65, that number's a lot less. But I didn't even know the basics of that math. And I had gone through Hudson High School. I had graduated from college cum laude. I studied business, and I did not know the basics of wealth creation.
I had a story like that too. Remember I said we met when we were both working at the World Trade Centers?
Mm-hmm.
I had an experience like that when I was filling out forms. They were like, do you want matching deposits into your, was it a 401k or something like that? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I don't want matching deposits. I want that money. So yeah, I didn't think about dying or anything, you know, or I'm not forget dying. I didn't think about what I need to do when I was going to retire. I didn't think about retiring. Who wants to retire? I want to live now, right? So I like that you brought that up, because anyone listening right now, if someone wants to match the amount of money you want to put in your retirement, put in the absolute highest amount possible. That just makes sense, right?
Well, it does, but it also requires not just knowledge, it requires a level of discipline, okay? If you get a paycheck each and every week, you have to make a conscious decision that I'm going to save a portion of that, okay, and put it aside. And then you have to make a conscious decision all the time. As that pool of money grows, it becomes more visible to you. And you start saying, well, I need a new car right now. So let me go and buy myself a new car. And so you tap into those funds because you're saying, hey, I don't need those funds for 30 years. So let me tap into them now. So you need to be disciplined, not just about putting the money away, but disciplined about not touching that pool of money once you've put it away, be recognizing that you're saving it for some later point in your life so that you can retire in dignity. And I think that's also a difficult thing for a lot of people to understand. It's not just about making a decision to put the money in a bank account or a savings account or a retirement account or a brokerage account. It is also about not touching it. And then there's decisions that people have to make along the way that are hard for them to accept as well. I'd love to own a new car. I can honestly say that it has been 24 years since I purchased a brand new car.
Whoa. And,
you know, most people don't know that about me, but I refuse to buy a new car. Why? Because the minute I drive it off the lot, it depreciates.
Absolutely.
And so I'd rather buy the 3-year-old Mercedes with 30,000 miles on it that someone has serviced, because I know that that car is good for 200,000 miles. And so when you look in my backyard, you see a 2008 and a 2009, and they still get me from point A to point B, and they are still very attractive cars, but the money that I've saved by a simple decision never to own something that is brand new, I can't tell you what that's been worth over the course of 20 or 25 years. It's probably worth several hundred thousand dollars.
Jacob, I'm going to stop you there. I think that's the greatest tidbit of information. We don't need new. We just need it to work, right? And think about every time you buy something that you're going to work an extra year for it. And when you look at that, I think you could try or look at your family and know that if you don't save now, then they're going to be put off. And we can't blame the system if we're not helping ourselves. So I love that. I'm going to go to our next segment. It's called Firsts. So my question to you, and then Bill, we're going to get to you with this. Do you know who our first African-American billionaire is or was? Okay, the clock is do 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 do. Was that Jeopardy? I mean, Jake, you can answer too if you want. You're just
I know it wasn't Robert Smith, so I don't know.
I think this is closest to you, Jake, because you kind of represent it in some way. I mentioned it.
So it's either Robert Smith, Bob Johnson, or Oprah Winfrey.
Robert Johnson, he became America's first Black billionaire in 2001, so 20 years ago. And I'm just going to give you a little information about him. Robert Louis Johnson, April 8th, 1946, was born in Hickory, Mississippi. His alma mater, so you talked about education, needing education. His alma mater was University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he got his BA, Bachelor's of Arts degree, and Princeton University, where he got his MPA. And of course, he's known for being a co-founder of BET, among other things. Of course, people with that kind of wealth, they can be known for everything, definitely being a person to give back and to sponsor others and organizations. So that's one. Can you tell me who the first Asian American billionaire was? Either of you?
No.
Oh boy.
From the US?
This one's harder. Patrick Soon-Shiong. He is the CEO of NantWorks, which is an owner of the Los Angeles Times and of the San Diego Tribune.
I once knew that, Kim.
I thought so. I thought I couldn't get anything over on you. But one of the billionaires that we talk about a lot now, he's all into cryptocurrency, right, Bill?
Which one?
How might, as someone looking at wealth, one? How might wealth be? Oh, I mean, I think crypto is really open to people of all ethnic diversities. All you need to know is a little bit about tech and a lot about currency, right?
Well, let's first of all, there's a great deal of education that need to be handed out about crypto. First of all, it shouldn't, I don't believe, and there's a lot of people believe it shouldn't be called a currency, first of all, because for the most part, most cryptos are protocols. They have utility for the ones that are worth something. And that utility isn't necessarily cash.
Can I just stop you there though? Because you said we shouldn't be calling it currency, but I know that in Switzerland right now, because I was going to buy something online, and they asked me, do I want to use my Bitcoin? So it can be used.
So go ahead. If you remember what I said, I said most. I didn't say all. So
very
Bitcoin,
good.
Bitcoin when it was developed by Satoshi Nakamoto, it really was a protest against the Bank of International, the BIS, and the central bank system. That's what it was. They wanted to decentralize and take out the intermediaries. So they want to get away from the local banks and banks loaning money to people and allowing people to be their own bank. That was the goal of Bitcoin. It didn't reach its goal though. By it happened to be mined and a whole lot of other things. Some are now trying to create it. A lot
of billionaires. Education. Can you let us know what it means to mine?
Okay, so you have these digital machines, essentially a computer in a pack that does a lot of algorithms, and it's supposed to figure out this equation. And when it does, it forms a block. Each block is formed together, which will then develop a coin, which is Bitcoin. And now that has gotten so competitive and so complicated that you actually have millions of these computers around the world that are connected trying to mine one coin. And this is why we're using so much energy on the blockchain protocol, the Bitcoin protocol. And it's the same, and they call that proof of work. The same process right now, which Ethereum is trying to switch from, is a proof of work protocol as well. Now, Ethereum is not like nothing like Bitcoin at all, right? One, Bitcoin is supposed to be for a store of value. They call it digital gold. Not sure that it's there yet, but that's what they call it. Ethereum is a smart contract. That's all it is. You can use it to do transactions, but smart contracts are a way to transfer value from one person to the other. That's essentially what you call a smart contract.
Let me give you an example. So when I was living in St. Kitts and Nevis, it's very hard to get money transferred to this country because it's a banana republic. I love the people there that are still there that I know, but it is what it is, and they'll be the first to tell you. You can't for sure get your mail delivered there intact on a regular basis. So this would help me if I'm there, because it will help me to get money and to exchange money in such a way that I don't need this bank in this country to help me with the transaction. Is that correct?
No, right? It's close, right? Governments don't want Bitcoin because Bitcoin is, anonymous. It's really hard to figure out who actually has the Bitcoin. Look, and people had to know this. There was no way that the sovereign governments and around the world was going to allow a currency to be established where you couldn't tell who owned it, who spent it, and where they spent it at. So the central bank stepped in, and they're now creating a whole digital currency called CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, which is nothing like Bitcoin. And it is nothing like Ethereum. It is basically each country developing their own dollar in a digital form. And so you have right now, China is probably in the lead with the digital yuan. but Russia, Nigeria, and just recently, people were saying, well, the U.S. wouldn't get involved. Well, if you watch Jay Powell, who is the Fed chair, coming out and said that, I don't believe that cryptocurrency would be a danger to the U.S. economy, and that we may pursue our own digital currency. Well, he told a half truth there, because there's no "we may" in it. He's sitting on the board of the Bank of International Settlements that develop digital currencies. The Fed has now come out with FedNow and saying that we're developing a digital currency. So I'm not quite sure why they're not telling the general public. But if you look at the whole financial system, and Jake, I know, would see some of this, the whole financial system, Kim, is changing. One, we got ISO 2022 that is going to come into effect in November of 2022. And two-thirds of that's the new messaging system, which was the old SWIFT. Two-thirds of that is going to be run by various cryptocurrency protocols. And that now, with a CBDC and the new cryptocurrency protocol, like you were saying, this country that you want to send money there, will happen in 30 seconds. Instead of it taking days or weeks or however long, you will now be able to send currency, regardless of what that currency is, you will be able to send it to any corner of the globe within 30 seconds. And the top protocol that you're able to do that right now is XRP and XLM. One is
going by the token.
What's that?
Okay. When you say XRP and XLM, are these, I don't want to call them currencies, so what should I call them?
Protocols.
Protocols. So are these protocols something that I can invest in?
They are.
Now, I'm asking
let me clarify that. So XRP...
Wait. Before you clarify, let me just tell you the reason for my question. It's because a lot of people have fear of banks. Remember, there are people I know growing up, I grew up on Columbia Street, where you would think someone was very poor, but they had all their money under their mattress. Mm-hmm. They didn't have it in a bank. Now we are able to keep it in a bank comfortably, but you still have people who don't even think credit is a good thing. When we know that the billionaires, even, they use other people's money, not theirs. And that's kind of how you get your wealth, by using other people's money to build your success financially. Mm-hmm. Am I right on that in some way? Yeah, credit's good if used appropriately. So how do we then go from kind of getting credit, feeling good about credit, to going to crypto? That's a big deal, right?
You as a citizen aren't going to have a choice on whether you want crypto or not. We're going to switch the system over to a central bank digital currency system. That's coming, whether it's coming in 2022 or 2025. It's coming. And when it does, and this is the thing I tell people on my secret group, is when it does come, it is not something to be afraid of, right? You learn the system and then use it for the greater good and invest in it early. So the fact that you know that cryptocurrency is going to be a tool that we're going to use in this country. I'm not saying that we're going to get rid of traditional fiat. I think you're going to have a combination of both, but I think the world will ultimately be dominated by crypto because of the easy use. You're going to have your phone will be everything. Your phone is going to be essentially what they call a hot wallet. And there's various hot wallets out now, the Atomic Wallet, Exodus Wallet. It's an app you download. You could download it on Google Play or some of these other sites that you can go and do app downloads.
Let me make sure, because we're going to run out of time. So I want to make sure the audience, at least I know I'm scratching my head literally. So when you say digital wallet, you're not talking about Apple Pay or anything like that.
So it's similar to Apple Pay, but it is not Apple Pay, because you can custody digital currency in this wallet. They call it a wallet. It really is a digital place to store your crypto off of the exchange. So when you buy crypto here's the difference between a wallet and exchange. Let's say you go on an exchange like Coinbase. When you buy your crypto on Coinbase, That crypto is still in the hands of Coinbase until you take it off the exchange and put it in a wallet. There's what you call a hot wallet, which is on your phone in the app. And then there's a hard wallet, which is a ledger, a nano ledger, that you can download the crypto and take it completely offline and put it on this almost like a thumb drive and put it in a safe deposit box. In fact, if you look at most of the billionaires and millionaires, Elon Musk and all these guys, they have nano ledgers. They buy their crypto, they take it offline, and they're storing it wherever they're storing it.
Okay.
But so it's important to make sure that the general public understands that we're now talking about an area that is outside of the skill set of most Americans.
Yes.
And is also a very high risk investment category. Mm-hmm. with a great deal of perception around it that it's an easy way to make money. Investing in crypto is not an easy way to make money.
I don't think there's an easy way of making money.
Well, so
85, 80, 90% type corrections.
Let me speak to what Jake is saying, because that's exactly true. You have a lot of crypto that came out there and people made millions. Look, you had, you know, Dogecoin, Shiba Inu, and they would go from 5 cents to $1, $2 overnight, and people would make millions of dollars. That's not the traditional way, though, in crypto. And that's not how I approach it. In fact, on my page, I don't even mention those cryptos because they have no utility. But the market itself is highly speculative, right? The whole entire market. What we know is the country is switching towards, not even the country, the whole world is switching towards a digital economy. And so what you want to do is figure out what are going to be the protocols that is going to run that digital economy. And that's why I dig so deep when I look. I want to hear what the World Economic Forum is saying. I want to hear what the BIS is saying. I want to hear what the federal banks are saying. I want to hear what those guys are saying. And if you go on their pages and you Google any one of them that I just mentioned, they're talking about is digital currencies and how they can add them into the protocol. And then when you look underneath, just because they have a digital currency, you need to move it. You need to be able to move it from country to country, from business to business, or peer to peer. In order to do that, you need to have a system sort of like SWIFT. Well, SWIFT is outdated. So what do you come up with to replace SWIFT? And what they came up with is ISO 2022, which has a whole lot, a list of crypto in it, and they list them. I mean, if you're looking for this information, just Google it. Just Google ISO 2022, and you'll see it. It'll say XLM, XRP, IOTA, which is IOTA, Algorand. They're right there. It's not like they even try to hide it. They put it right there in plain sight. But they know for the fact that most people aren't going to do this digging or aren't going to read.
I'm going to have to stop you there because, like you said, most people might not do it, but this was just an opportunity for the listeners, the audience, to get an understanding of where we were, where we are, and that we can move forward with, like everyone mentioned here, education, right? To educate yourself on everything that we've mentioned. We have about 2 minutes left. Is there any last words you want to share after I share a word with one of my LinkedIn connections who knows Will, because his name is Roosevelt Moore, and he wanted us to talk about Powernomics. And I'm not saying that I didn't give the space because I didn't want to talk about it. It's just that I didn't have time to talk about it. So I'd like to give a shout out to him and let him know that he is welcome at any time to come on and talk more about people who have visions about how Black people and how other people of different persuasions could be economically sound in the future. Certainly, lots of people have written about it, and Googling that would be an opportunity for people to be successful with more knowledge and education. Any last words with 1 minute to go?
No, I think we should do another show because it's really important about that people really understand crypto, not from the protocol perspective, but from the opportunity perspective, as far as